You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Today's pod is with Zach Mercurio, who works with individuals and organizations worldwide to forge purposeful leaders who cultivate more meaning, mattering, well-being, and performance. He is a positive leadership and organizations researcher, an honorary fellow of psychology in the Center for Meaning and Purpose at Colorado State University. He wrote the book, The Invisible Leader. His research has been awarded by the Association for Talent and Development in the Academy of Management, and he contributes regularly to the international media outlets. He has a new book. It's called The Power of Mattering, How Leaders Can Create a Culture of Significance. Enjoy the pod.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job, at the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops. But over time, the expectation.
Zach Mercurio, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Kelly. Happy to be here.
I want to start with the last lines of your book because I think they offer the perfect prompt for the modern leader. You write, quote, "Here's a good rule for every leader. Always assume the people around you feel unseen, undervalued, and lonely, and act accordingly," end quote. Say more.
One of my favorite proverbs is a Navajo proverb. It's actually on hospitality. And it says, always assume your guest is tired, cold, and hungry, and act accordingly. I mean, imagine the meal you would prepare or the attention to detail you would have if you assumed that. You know, our assumptions drive our actions. Oftentimes, we underestimate the impact that we have on others, especially in small ways. And right now, we're facing a mattering deficit. I mean, more people feel unseen, undervalued, and lonely than really, when we look at the data, than in recent history. One out of every three people feels persistently lonely. And one of the things that we know is that what predicts loneliness is not the quantity of your connections. It's not going out connecting. It's the quality of your connections. And quality connections are connections in which we feel seen, in which we feel heard, in which we feel needed. And we can do that for someone in our next interaction. And so imagine a world in which we all saw each other as, man, this person could potentially feel unseen, unheard, unvalued, and lonely. How would that change how we show up?
It's so interesting because the data supports this, right? Science supports these ideas. And yet we have a significant part of our culture, and I'm talking political, I'm talking some CEOs, people like that, who find it as a point of weakness when it is the hardest thing to do, to give of yourself to see others, to choose to lift up the group. It's sacrifice. It's all these things. And yet it gets sort of painted with this brush that somehow it's the weak thing to do. And I don't know. I'm trying to find a way to square those two things.
I think one of the reasons why is, I forget his name, but there was a military psychologist in the 1960s that called these skills soft.
Yeah.
And I'm really not happy that he did that because... Because what happens is when your brain sees something as soft or simple, you will approach it with less rigor.
Yeah.
And, you know, we tend to develop an overconfidence bias as well, that we're just better at these things than we actually are, and they don't really need much rigor, and they don't really need much preparation, and it doesn't take much skill to do that, so we think of these things as soft. The other problem is that we tend to be obsessed with lagging indicators, right? We tend to be obsessed with productivity or engagement. I mean, those are already things that have already happened. They're lagging indicators. The leading indicator is human energy. And, you know, regenerating the human energy needed to perform and produce. And so it's a bit of two things. One is, I think we've relegated these things to be simple or soft. Two, I think we're obsessed with trying to pursue results by pursuing results instead of the cause. And I think we need to go back to really seeing humans and their energy as the leading indicator for everything else. And that's why, you know, if someone doesn't feel cared for, they're not going to care.
Yeah.
You know, we can't keep expecting something to matter to someone who doesn't feel that they matter. You know, and we see this, employee engagement has been flatlined, for example, in work for a decade. Mm-hmm. It's the lowest it's been in a decade. That's despite employee engagement becoming a $1 billion industry. And why is that? Well, there's one piece of data that shows up time and time again. Just about 39% of people say that someone cares about them as a person in work.
Mm. You frame the book with basically stories about janitors, maintenance people, and they're beautiful. And so can we start with, you had an encounter with a university janitor this like 8 years ago, right? That's the first story of the book. Can you talk about that?
Well, there's two. There's one that launched me into this whole work, right? I was a PhD student. I was struggling with a research interest. I was in these academic buildings late at night. And so the janitors became my friends, friends I didn't know I needed.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's remarkable how much meaning we make in these everyday interactions. And how much meaning is available in these everyday interactions. But I was going to a free training on campus, and I was really excited about it. I was walking down the hall. Janitor came up to me. She said, oh, where are you going? What are you doing today? I said, I'm going to this free meeting, free training and meeting. And she said, how'd you hear about this? I said, oh, it was in my email. And she just deflated. Hmm. And she said, you know, I've been here for 10 years. No one showed me how to get my email up and running. And I thought, wow, this is at a university.
Right.
Right? What's happening elsewhere? So we embedded ourselves with a group of custodians for a year and a half trying to understand what made work meaningful in a very difficult, overlooked job. And what we found was that it was very small moments, what we call, you know, moments of mattering, where someone sees them, someone looks them in the eye and thanks them instead of brushing by. Someone asks how they're doing, remembers a detail about their lives. And those moments tended to change the trajectories of people's careers and how they saw themselves. But on the flip side, small moments of feeling that you don't matter, that you're insignificant, that you're unseen, that you're unimportant, that you're not important enough to show you how to get your email out and running. Those moments often derail people's self-beliefs. And so since that, I mean, we've spent like 5 years trying to understand what are the ingredients of these moments of mattering. And gosh, you know, one person in that study said to me, you know, don't give me a free sandwich and a certificate. Remember my name and say thank you.
Yeah.
And, you know, we can do that in our next interaction. You know, we can do something about this loneliness epidemic in our next interaction. We can do something about it because these moments can have massive implications on someone's life. And that's what led me here today, and I learned so much from people on the front line doing everyday work that, you know, I'm indebted to, and I have a place. I mean, that work is where I start, where I like coming back to, because if you just go into an airport and you go into that bathroom and you see a custodian there, instead of just nudging yourself by that car, look them in the eye and say, hey, I just want to thank you for being here so I can be here. And watch what happened.
When I was reading about this, I immediately flashed one of my, I would say one of my closest friends / mentors was the janitor at my grade school, Ken. And he was Nigerian and he played soccer and I played soccer. And so, you know, when he would have breaks, we'd go out and play. And then after school, we'd do that and other people. And it was the relationship I needed. It was someone we would have really interesting conversations. Just like a good human, and you know, not an easy job. I mean, like when I started at Second City, I had to clean up puke. It's not fun. And I always use this phrase where I say meaning is made in moments, but I guess it's the same for mattering is made in moments.
Yeah, and the difference, I guess, is that it's hard to just make meaning on our own.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we find is that we need the evidence of our significance around us. And you know, one of the second story that I tell.
Yeah, good. I want you to get to this.
Yeah, just because this has profoundly impacted me, was with a janitor named Jane. And I start the book with this. And Jane was near homelessness. She needed a job. She said that during her first couple months on the job, she kept saying to herself, why couldn't I have done something more with my life? You know, why am I just a janitor? She said that she would clock in, clock out. You know, that's it. And she said that in her second month, there was a supervisor who noticed her, that she was struggling. He brought her into this room and he put a dictionary in front of her and opened it to the word custodian. And he had her read it out loud, a person responsible for a building and everyone in it. And he said, that's you. And I remember in this interview, she looked at me and she was crying. And she said, that was the first time in my life that someone ever made me feel worthy. And she said that seeing that evidence of my significance changed my belief systems about myself. And she's been at the university now for over 18 years. We stay in touch. She's one of the most sought-after janitors. But what is so sophisticated is what the leader did. And people feel significant when their environment reminds them of their significance. It's very difficult for us to like develop our self-beliefs on our own. Like I can't, if I sit in my office and I say, oh, I believe in myself, but then I go in environments that give me the evidence of the opposite, I will start believing that I'm insignificant. And that's the role we play for each other. What that supervisor did is he gave her the indisputable evidence of her significance. He put it out there. This is a dictionary. This is the definition of your job. This is the impact that you make. Here it is. And that's what we find that people who create mattering for others do, is they create an environment that regularly shows them the evidence of their significance that helps them to believe that they have meaning. You know, it's different than just saying, hey, don't forget that you matter. I mean, or you matter. That's helpful. But showing people exactly how they matter is the skill.
There's a nuance to this too that I picked up. We had Rosalind Chao on the podcast with talking about her book, The Doors You Can Open. And she talks about the difference between mentoring and sponsorship. And she goes, mentoring is when you're talking to someone. Sponsoring is when you're talking about someone.
Mm.
It's really profound. And it's like, oh, that. And I recognize that a thing in my career that I've done over time is I tell people when other people are speaking well of them behind their back.
Mm.
And that's how I phrase it. And it's
that's
like
that evidence.
Yeah. And they should know that people, like when they're not around, speak well of them. And I can tell it always has impact on people. But it's like, why would you not share that? It's like you have to share so much bad stuff all the time. It's like, take those moments, those little victories, and give them to people.
I love that. And I'll tell you why we don't share it. It's called an underestimation bias. There's been studies done by a psychologist, Nick Epley, where he had people like send thank you, like gratitude notes, thank you notes to people. And he had the giver rate how impactful they think those notes would be. And then he had the recipient rate how impactful receiving those notes would be. Every single time, the giver underestimated the emotional impact of the simple note. He's done this with check-ins and other, just talking to a stranger. And every time we underestimate, because we have a difficult time actually believing in our interdependence, that we are part of someone's life. And what words we give them, what demeanor we show them is part of their environment, and it helps form their beliefs. And so I think you have an evidence-based pass to overestimate your impact. And that goes back to how you open that's how you opened the podcast.
Yeah.
That's why I say assume that people around you feel unseen, unheard, unvalued, and lonely, and act accordingly, because that allows you to overestimate your impact, that there's something you can do.
So Nick Epley was one of our partners. We did a 4-year program with him and his colleagues at the University of Chicago called the Second Science Project, which looked at improvisation through behavioral science and vice
Beautiful.
Versa.
Beautiful. I love when that happens.
So we would design these exercises based on his research, you know, so lack of self-disclosure. We create an exercise about that. Because what we know is behavior change is not going to happen from reading a book, but it will happen with embodied practice. You know, in the same way that I wanted to make sure I worked out every morning, so I created a series of rituals that I do every morning that include me with my workout clothes in a specific space. They're all put out, you know, all that stuff. And these biases, the heuristics, it's all, you know, it's human behavior. And what is improv except for, you know, an expression of human behavior? And I think the thing that also people don't recognize is like you have to make it habit forming for it to have impact. You can't say it once and it's done. You know, it's like, nope, you got to say it and keep saying it. You know, it's funny that like marketing executives know this, you know, and psychologists know this, but none of that seems to transfer out of that ivory tower into our day-to-day businesses.
And we have to apply those principles that you're talking about habit formation.
Yeah.
When it comes to caring for people.
Yeah.
And that's really what my work is all about. I mean, that's it. Because common sense is not common practice. A lot of people say to me, Zach, this stuff's common sense. You know, why do you have a job? You know, kid, I have a fourth grader now. And yeah. I remember one of his friends asked him what I did. And he goes, my dad helps people be nice to each other.
And you know what? That's what a gift that is.
Yes. What a gift. But also, it was so obvious to him. Yeah. But, you know, what's common sense isn't common practice. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the things I always say is that the best way you can start doing this is to schedule your good intentions.
Yeah.
So I'm the nicest person in the world when I'm out walking my dog. I think about all the people I should thank, all the letters I should write, you know, all the people I should check in with. But I get back into my office and I look at my to-do list and I just jump right into it. Put it on your calendar. Mm-hmm. Elevate it to your to-do list to check in, write that thank you note. We have to elevate this stuff into what you talk about, embodied practice. And these things like noticing, affirming, showing people how they're needed, things like caring for people, it's an act, right? It's action. Mm-hmm. And sometimes motivation follows action.
Was it Indira Nui at Pepsi who did that thing where she would send letters to her employees' parents to say how great they were?
Yes.
I mean, that's genius, because what more could you want than your parent to be proud of you?
Yes. On Mother's Day, I worked with a leader at the Arizona Diamondbacks, the MLB team.
Yeah.
On Mother's Day, she would write to their mothers a Mother's Day card. And they would say, Happy Mother's Day. Thank you for sharing so-and-so with us. And she would write down attributes of that person that she appreciated. Mm-hmm. And this was hundreds of people.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what I also love is, you know, we listen to stories like that. And we're like, wow, like what an amazing leader. These are amazing people. But it's learnable. You know, they take the time. They set the time aside. They actually write a good thank you note. They take time into being specific. And they do it. And I think we need to elevate the rigor to which we approach these skills of caring for people, because we can learn these things.
Let's talk some semantics. Mattering isn't the same as belonging.
No, it's not.
Okay, what's the difference?
It's not the same as inclusion either. And it's not the same as meaningfulness.
Self-esteem. Yeah, and self-esteem. Yeah. So yeah, let's talk about those. How are these all different?
Yeah, mattering is the belief that you're significant. So belonging is feeling part of a group. It's like I liken it to, I have elementary school kids. So school recess game, right? Belonging is being picked for the team, being asked to play. Inclusion, let's add that in there. Inclusion is being able to play in the game.
Yeah.
And mattering is feeling like the team wouldn't be complete without you. It's feeling significant to people. So the difference is, if I were to do a belonging intervention in an organization, for example, or with a team, we would focus on social connection, on making sure people feel welcome, connected. If I'm doing an inclusion intervention, I'm focusing on people of various perspectives, identities, get the opportunity to contribute. But if I'm doing a mattering intervention, I'm focusing on making sure that people have the skills to make the next person they interact with feel seen, heard, valued, and needed. I can be on this in this podcast with you, feel like I belong here, but not feel seen by you.
Mm-hmm.
I can feel like I belong in a meeting room or feel included, but have no one noticed that my parent is in the hospital, or have no one named my unique gifts or my unique strengths. So mattering's very different. It's also, it's not a nice habit. It's actually more instinctual than it is anything else. The first thing we do as people is we search to matter to someone to keep us alive.
Uh-huh.
We have two reflexes. We reach out our arms. It's called a grasp reflex, to find somebody to care for us. We have an instinctual need to matter to someone to keep us alive. And that is the seed of our deep psychological need to feel seen, heard, and valued and needed. So a lot of people call this stuff touchy-feely, but it's just about as touchy-feely as feeding someone who's hungry when you get down to it.
Yeah. So I get completely how a leader can do that for his people or her people. How about the individual? Are there ways that you can amp up the way that people perceive how you matter?
This is what's hard about mattering. Mattering is one of the most powerful psychological concepts. It's also been neglected because it relies on all of us. We can't wait until we're self-actualized enough to go do it for other people. One of the problems is that over the past 50 years, we've told people they need to help themselves. They need to actualize themselves. There's no committee in your head that says, you're actualized now, go help other people.
No, it's always relational.
It's always relational. And so we need to be out also taking action to get action. There's this great principle. It's called the complementarity principle. I know psychologists have all sorts of work. But it goes like this. You know, if I want you to ask about my life, my personal life, the best way to do that is to start asking about your personal life. Right? So a lot of people say, like, well, what if my leader doesn't do this for me? I say, well, do you do it for them? But somebody has to go first.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of this boomerang effect that one of the best ways to feel that you matter is to show other people how they matter.
Yeah.
So like, you can do this on an everyday basis. You're going to the grocery store. You're in the checkout line. You want to get home, get on your bike, get in your car, wherever you're going. Take the time and just say, introduce yourself to the grocery store clerk that's checking you out. Ask them, hey, what's been most exciting about your day so far? First of all, you'll see someone startled to be seen.
Yes.
But then research shows that you're going to go home and you start feeling different. I guarantee you, you'll start feeling different. You'll feel like you did something, right? Like you added value to someone's life. And guess what? That's evidence. That's the evidence. You're creating the evidence that, yes, you are significant because you saw that person smile when you asked that question.
So this is, of course, literally how we teach improvisation, because you have no script. So you have to say, all right, you're going to get there. Everything someone says to you is a gift. And the whole yes and concept is you say yes to it and you explore on that. And then they do the same. And that's how you build something out of nothing. It is inherently pro-social.
Wow.
Right? It seems absolutely obvious when you talk about it. But and this is also why, I mean, I've worked at Second City 38 years. I can, on one hand, count the number of assholes. That's astounding in the comedy
industry. That is astounding, yes.
But
my uncle's a comedian.
Yeah, is he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paul Mercurio, if you've ever heard
of him. Okay. I know Paul Mercurio. Yeah. And it's like we don't do stand-up, we do improv. So everyone has to learn these improv skills, and it is inherently easy to take them with you off stage, you know, in the way, because you have to learn to listen better. So, you know, there's exercises here that force you to listen to the end of someone's sentence and then pause them and respond. And not only is that fantastic for you because you're actually learning more because you're listening all the way to the end, talk about being heard, right? Like you're literally listening to everything I say. Well, that's a powerful tool to have in your toolbox.
I would imagine, and tell me if I'm wrong, the practice of doing that builds a ton of trust.
Oh, yeah, it's all trust. I mean, that's why things like trust falls come out of like the theater, or mirroring exercises come out of theater, right? I mean, it seems so obvious, you know, as you talk about it, but no, it because if you don't have You cannot be creative if you're working in fear, a fear state, and you can't be successful in improvisation if you're in judgment of self or judgment of others.
Mm.
And one of the space, go ahead.
Oh, no. One of the things that is really interesting is a lot of the research on mattering shows that when we feel that we matter to others in these environments, we actually have less negative thoughts about ourselves and have more self-compassion.
Yeah.
Because again, we have that safety net. A lot of people think that, and this is reminding me about some of the work on confidence. A lot of people think that I develop confidence on my own by just sitting here and being like, I'm going to go out on stage and be confident.
Mm-hmm.
But we actually become confident because we know someone has our back. We know that someone believes in us. This is why the mattering work goes back to childhood attachment theory. That's where a lot of it came out of adolescent attachment theory. Because a child is more likely to go out, experiment, take risks, and learn because they know when they come back, they already matter to somebody. One of the best signs of like a healthy household is when kids are being loud in front of their parents.
I get
it. Kids are being loud at a restaurant, I think, okay, that's good. Because they know they can be out there experimenting because someone still feels that they matter. Now, all of this stuff, we don't like talking about it in work because we're not going to say, let's talk about childhood attachment at work. So we call it psychological safety.
Yeah, that's right.
Because really it's about having each other's back. And I think what you're talking about is that when somebody feels heard, when somebody listens to their whole sentence, and in the improv world, when somebody makes space for somebody and gives them the space to like, be flounder a little bit and find their way, but there for them. That's what mattering is actually all about.
Yeah, your job. We teach that your job is to save the person across from you, and their job is to save you.
Amazing.
That's the default.
And knowing someone's there to save you.
Yeah.
How else
could you do it?
How else could you do life?
Right. That's what I'm saying. Yes.
But we tried. We're trying. We're trying to do it.
Yes, we are. And your point to at what point did someone decide that, oh, the world of work, any other sort of rules of life, psychology, neuroscience, caregiving, all the things we understand, sociology, anthropology, anything else? Yeah, it's different because someone's in a suit.
Yeah, you clock in and your brain falls out and your heart stops, right?
Real life severance? I mean, I don't get it.
There is an explanation, and it happened when we started treating work as exchange. So I have something and I'm going to give you something for doing it. So the moment we see a human as a means to an end, they cease to become human to us. It's easy to dehumanize people. But work inherently mattered. So like if you were a cobbler and you made shoes, you made shoes so I could not walk around with my bare feet. You saw it. But then someone came along and was like, well, I have this factory. If you just come in and if you take a little less meaning and mattering and you come in and just make the sole of the shoe, I'll pay you enough money to deal with that emotional infliction of harm so you can go home. And then it's just work. It's just a job anyway. And that's when it started. You know, when we started treating people as machines, as means to an end, work as exchange. And I think now what you're seeing, though, is that people are starting to realize and ask those questions. Why am I doing what I'm doing? What am I doing? What do I want to experience in the place where I'm spending a third of my waking life? A lot of people have more choice now of where, when, and how to earn a living, even in frontline work. Literacy rates are up. Educational attainment is up. I can go drive an Uber. I don't have to put up with your disrespect every day.
Yeah.
And so I think now organizations, and we're starting to take this more seriously, and the reason why somebody even published my book is because on mattering, right?
Yeah.
At a business press is because people have more choice of where, when, and how to earn a living. With more choice comes more discernment. And when we discern where we're going to spend our time, we discern it based on how we feel. And so I believe that what we're talking about and returning to, yes, you matter, your work matters, I can see you, hear you, value you, is going to be essential. And you also mentioned something else. There's the difference between the meaning of work and meaning in work.
Yeah.
A lot of people say to me, oh, Zach, well, my people are just here to earn a paycheck. That's fine. That's great. Wow. Like they're doing something really hard. They're giving up a third of their waking life to provide for their life or people around them. That's a noble purpose. But that could be the meaning of work. The meaning in work is what they experience when they're there. And that's something everybody has control over, those experiences, yeah. Those relationships.
It's interesting because you talk about in the book that COVID bared this, right? It's because it created choice maybe where people didn't know there was, or they got off the hamster wheel. They're like, why am I even on this thing? I look at AI and I wonder if that's going to be the true reckoning of this, is when even more of those jobs simply don't exist. And do we have government institutional will? I was going to say structure, but like will to address that for that potential crisis.
Yeah, there's two things related to technology right now. One of those is that we have to also go back even pre-AI conversation. Many of us who are leading people, who interact with people every day, myself included, have spent the last 20 years being able to send short text-based messages to each other instead of being in social situations where we actually have to see, hear, value one another. You know, I was thinking about this recently. My grandfather was in the hospital. He had a stroke. My mom was taking care of him. It's a very difficult time. And I remember I was leaving to go to the airport, and I was in my truck, and I just texted, I hope everything goes well today. And I said to myself, wait a minute. I felt like I did something. Oh, I checked the box off. But I can do that and say I did my empathy work today. I don't have to call her anymore and talk through that. So the skill to actually show compassion has been withering. As we've been able to communicate via short transactions, we haven't been in social situations to develop these skills. You know, if you give me some good news, I can just give you a thumbs up emoji and say, good job. I don't have to sit with you and say, Kelly, I'm really proud of you. I've noticed you've worked on this for the past 4 years. I can see your perseverance. That's a skill. If you give me some bad news, I can just send a sad-faced emoji. I'm sorry to hear that. As we've been not using these skills, we're not as good at them. And that's so I think we actually need a major reskilling to re-implement these skills to see, hear, value one another. And then you add AI, and AI is eclipsing our operational ability. So what do we have left? What we have left is to make sure the next person we interact with feels understood.
Yeah, here's the good news. The good news is the thing we have left is our humanness and what that means with regard to storytelling, problem solving, creativity. AI is not funny. I mean, yes, I don't know if it'll ever be, but it's not relatable in that same way. You're not going to go to Second City to see screens on a stage. You would stay home and do that. And I was just here last week for the show. We're in the process of creating a new show, and like it always is. It's magic when groups of people who don't know each other come in a room and laugh at the same time. It's you know, in a similar way to a concert, right? Where we're all singing together, and it's like those moments are joyous and transcendent, and we need them. You know, we need to be in these groups because there's individual mattering and there's group mattering, I'd imagine, as well.
Yeah, AI is not producing its own oxytocin yet.
No.
And oxytocin, right? And dopamine. Those are the chill you get. You know, that's what that is. It's feeling connected to another human being in the shared space. It's having our minds mirror someone else's mind. And then the intangible, right, of coming together. I think that's also what happens in these moments. You know, that moment, I don't think AI would have pulled out the dictionary and showed Jane the definition of custodian, right? There's something remarkably magical about our human intuition when we notice someone in need.
So there's certain thinkers who come up, you know, Carl Rogers, you talk about, he comes up in the podcast, John Gottman comes up, and you talk about this idea of bids. And I want you to talk a little bit about that more. So I think Gottman referred to it, I believe, as the fundamental unit of emotional communication.
Yes, and I love the word unit.
Yeah, talk more about bids.
Bids of connection are when people are non-verbally or verbally reaching out for connection, but they're not saying I'm reaching out for connection. So, and it often happens in the in-between small moments. You know, John Gottman talks about how it's the small, seemingly insignificant in-between moments of our life and our work where people bid for connection. So it could be at the end of a call when somebody's like, hey, did you hear that podcast interview? They may not be wanting you to say, yes, I heard about it, but they're wanting you to take an interest in them. Mm-hmm. And there are a few ways we respond to these small bids for connection. We either turn toward them and say, no, I haven't. Tell me about it. We turn away from them. We say, oh, no, you know, no, I haven't heard that one yet, but I got to go. Mm-hmm. Or we objectively turn against them. And we say, I don't really have time for podcasts.
Yeah.
So, but it's these small moments, like when you're in a one-on-one with somebody and they share, hey, I have this great idea. I'm working on this new idea. You could say, oh, let me hear more about that. I mean, this is an improv.
Yeah. Does that right? That's what
yes,
I want to talk about.
You know, yeah. Let me hear more about that. And asking good questions of, you know, what's most exciting about that for you? Or, you could turn away. Or you can turn against. An example comes to mind with my kid. So I'm a parent. Again, it's important if everybody reading this book to know I'm writing this for me.
Yeah, sure.
I'm learning as I'm writing and I'm researching. And my kid, he's 10, he's going on 11, and he has like tablet time, screen time. And he every time I say, hey, turn the screen off, he'll throw this like tantrum, uh-huh. Right? No, I don't want to. Why do you always have to do that? It's actually a bid. That tantrum is a bid for connection. And I learned this because one day, instead of saying, hey, shut it off, I sat down on the couch with him. I was doing dishes in the kitchen. And I said, hey, what are you watching? And he said, oh, he was surprised. And he told me about the show. And I said, oh, what do you like about the characters? And what was amazing is that slowly the tablet got shut off. And we started talking. And so often we treat each other as transactions. Here's some stuff I need you to do for me. Here's some information I need from you. Here's some information I have for you. But when we get down with somebody, we ask deeper questions. We take an interest. That, and we notice these bids for connection. That is where these moments happen. And it transformed how I think about this. Yeah.
So you're making me think, I'm going to go back to Epley. So my wife, Anne, is teaching this class at Northwestern right now at the Farley School for Entrepreneurship. Basically, it's improv, using improv to help you with your pitches for these really brainy engineering students. And she was telling me about her last class. And she did one of the exercises that, based on Epley's research around self-disclosure, it's called Universal Unique. And so you partner people up and you say, okay, you're going to have a conversation about grocery shopping. But you're just going to talk about how human beings grocery shop, the generic we, and they do that. And she goes, okay, you've done that for a couple minutes. Now what you're going to do is have a conversation about how you personally grocery shop. Completely different. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's as you're sharing these details. Like when I do it, I barely get to the grocery store because there's all these other things that happen. And everyone's like, no, I totally learned about that. I was like, yeah, you're talking about grocery shopping. So at the end of class, she's like, all right, we're going to meet in a week. I want you to take that exercise, the ideas in that exercise, and apply it somewhere in your life. And she does a list of, like, you could do it in a conversation here, you could do it with a cut. And the next week, she went, okay, what everyone's got to share what they did and how it worked. And this one woman goes, so I talk to my parents every Sunday. I've done that every single week I've been at college on the phone. And this is the first week ever where we didn't just share a list of the things we were doing.
Wow.
Wow,
your parents.
Building.
Like your parents.
Her parents, exactly. And you know that, I mean, you're not there yet. Like, I have a 27-year-old. The parenting, there's like no books on this, right? The parenting of young adults and that. Because it changes. But this is what you want.
Right.
Because it can fall into the other.
And it's the difference between a transactional interaction and a transformational interaction.
Yeah.
And And it requires some of these skills, right? It requires asking better questions of one another, right? How are you? How's it going? Those are greetings. In our Western society, those are greetings. They're not questions.
Yeah. And you know, you can imagine what she's doing is sort of saying, oh, yeah, like, so I specifically went to this specific place and this specific thing happened and then this happened and made me feel like this. And that's a different, you're having this rich, layered conversation that has emotion and value and purpose and all the different things. Again, I've been in the list conversation when my son calls on occasion. It's like, right. It takes work to get you out of that because it's harder.
Now imagine this is happening with parents and their adult children. Imagine what's happening in work.
Yeah.
Right. Where we've separated work and life, as you said, there's really no separation. I mean, that's saying that life occurs wherever a person is alive, right? And that includes in work. But we've made it so easy to treat people like transactions.
Yeah. You talk about the fact that so Second City gets brought in a lot for workshops around listening, because obviously the art of improvisation, you have to be an incredible listener. Part of the reason we get brought in is because there's no one else doing this. I mean, I'm trying to recall if anyone ever truly taught me how to listen. And the answer is no, until I got involved with improv.
Yeah, researchers estimate that less than 2% of the world gets any formal education on how to listen well. And if we do, it's co-opted Carl Rogers research on active listening. Yeah. And what I mean by that is what they'll do is they'll say, okay, come to my listening workshop, nod, make eye contact, say, mm-hmm, right? You can do all of those things, but the person across from you may not feel heard. So there is a big difference between physically listening to someone and ensuring they feel heard. You know, Carl Rogers' approach was around listening for total meaning. What that means is that feeling heard is having our voice. And our voice, I use it like a capital V voice. The voice is our unique perspective, our unique way of seeing the world and our environment around us, our opinions, our unique feedback, and inviting that out. When we feel like that is invited out, we feel heard. But he calls it listening for total meaning. And it's things like this. Like if you came on, if after this podcast, someone was like, how was the podcast? And you're like, oh, it was great. And then, or rewind and you do that again and you say, oh, it was great. There's two different meanings there.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm someone who helps you feel heard, I need to pick up on that and say, oh, Kelly, I'm noticing that you're not as excited as usual. Like I sense a little bit of like, you're sort of disappointed. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Am I getting that right? And then all of a sudden you start feeling heard versus if someone was like, oh, that's great, Kelly, let's go on with our day. And this happens in little moments all of the time. Like if you're saying, hey, you know, how was your weekend? And they're like, oh, not good. I didn't have anything to do. That requires a much different level of skill and attention than if someone says, oh, you know, as usual, I didn't have much to do. Same words. The meaning is different. And so great listeners, people who actually help people feel heard, go to the meaning behind the words.
I don't know if you're aware of Alison Woodbrooks's work, a Harvard professor, and she's got a book on the science and art of conversation called Talk. And it's great. And she's a pal. But one of the things that she talks about is in any conversation, you are doing something and the other person is doing something. And people will chafe at this initially, like, you know, what do you mean I'm doing something? It's like, you are doing something. There's some kind of want. That is happening. So first, sort of being aware of that, of what are you doing, and then these conversations are there's so much going on that you know to truly pay attention is hard. But you should, and you need lots of different skills. It's again, you know, people do default to that active listening thing. It's like there's more. There's so much more that could be happening. She talks about this wonderful conversation between Stephen Colbert and Anderson Cooper, where they're talking about grief and they interrupt each other. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, right? They interrupt each other, but not in a way that's like they're excited because of the thing and they want to build it. The other is there too. So it's like it's building the rules of the conversation as you go forward. And you can do that with someone when you're really paying attention.
Yeah, there's a study I write about where researchers looked at managers giving feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And they had the feedback recipients rate how good of a listener the managers were. And they were trying to figure out what the managers did who were rated as good listeners in those feedback conversations. And a lot of people say, like, oh, to be a good listener, you shouldn't give advice. You should just stay quiet. But actually, the people who were rated as good listeners gave a lot of advice. But what they did do before is they sought understanding and helped the people feel understood and heard before they gave advice. It's like when we're critiquing people, we tend to critique before we care. Like, what you say is not going to matter to somebody if they don't feel that their voice matters to you. So the good listeners, it wasn't that they didn't ask advice, they didn't interject. It was that they first made sure the person and their voice felt significant.
Yeah.
And felt, and they relentlessly sought to understand before they sought to evaluate.
One of the exercises we have is called should, could. And we say, you're going to share a problem you have, and the person across from you is going to respond, well, you should, and the things you should. Or in the next round, you're going to say, you could.
Oh, cool.
Game changer.
Yes.
So we're, you know, this is the thing. Words are important. They really are. And some of the, what we think are unimportant words are important. This is all great stuff. We always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. So I'm going to put you on the spot to improvise one right now.
Okay. So, I got asked, I was at a Chamber of Commerce event locally. And leader of a commercial plumbing contracting company said, oh, we have a slot to do a 30-minute talk, but it's after a 14-hour shift.
Oof.
And for plumbers, commercial plumbers.
Yep.
And we have to do it in our warehouse, so it's a little bit cold, but we'll cater sandwiches. I want you to do it around purpose and meaning at work. And my initial thought was, let me make an excuse.
Yes. Oh, I never would have said yes to this. Let alone yes and.
But I said yes.
Ahead. Yeah, you did.
I said yes. And I researched this plumbing company, and I researched the projects they worked on. And lo and behold, one of the projects they worked on was a new plaza in the city that I'm in. And in that plaza was my then 6-year-old's favorite donut shop that when his younger sibling was born, I would take him to on Saturday mornings. It was a him and I thing because he felt overloaded, you know? And I realized I had this picture of him stuffing his face with a donut, you know, and closing his eyes. And I went in to the group and I was really nervous. I remember they like turned their chairs away from me as I was starting to eat their sandwiches, like Subway sandwiches. And I put the picture up of my kid stuffing his face with this donut. And I said, what do you notice here? And they said, oh, it's that's the exchange. That's the plaza we worked on. I go, yeah. And my kid was like closing his eyes, eating something. When you close your eyes and you eat something, that's pure joy. I said, do you see this pure joy? I was like, you made this happen. And that whole room changed. I mean, it changed. And I had a journeyman plumber come up to me after and say, I've been doing this job for 30 years and I've never thought about my job that way. And I said, what do you mean? He said, the people who benefit from the buildings that I've done this plumbing infrastructure for. And I feel like my whole career has been sort of unconventional in the research I do and the work I do, because it is a yes. And a lot of people, I've found myself on airplanes with cleaning crews, cleaning airplanes and finding out how people who clean airplanes find meaning. People who are plumbers who you'd say, oh, that's a tough crowd. And so the yes and has actually, now that I think about it and categorize it that way, has brought me into people's worlds that otherwise I would have never entered into, and I wouldn't be where I am today. So it's just a great question.
I love it. The book is called The Power of Mattering, How Leaders Can Create a Culture of Significance. Zach Mercurio, thank you for coming on the pod.
Thanks, Kelly.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Adulthood, no one survives.